were outlined by early snow. The carpet still took its streak of sun, and she saw the mark where it had faded through the years. On the washstand was the big red and white bowl, the pitcher inside it, just as they had stood through her childhood, and through the misted window was the same quiet street, and the same three white houses, and the same gentle swell of open country dotted with bare trees. Like smoke that rose and filled a room, the feeling swelled in her that she had never breathed properly since she had run away from home. Dakota had been too open, a place of wind and empty sky. Seattle had been tenements in crowded streets and the interminable drifting rain. The tent house where she had almost got the feeling of home had been huddled closely within a circle of woods. But here there was both shelter and space. Here was home, even if she was unwelcome in it. The changelessness of the house and the strip of quiet street and the swell of farmland was like an open and reassuring door. She heard Kristen talking without being fully aware of what she said. There was a sad, sweet relaxation in all her bones, as if she had just taken off a rigid corset after hours of formality. Then Kristen's talk paused, and Elsa looked up to see her holding a dress she had just taken from the telescope. The dress was cheap, too much laundered, and the instant defensive words jumped to Elsa's lips. "I've had that dress ever since we lived in Hardanger. I ought to have thrown it away years ago, but you know how you hang on to things." "Yes," Kristen said quietly, and hung the dress in the wardrobe, but there was a vague hostility between them. Elsa had no idea what they all thought about her leaving Beau. Maybe they thought she had left because he wasn't a good provider, as if she were as disloyal and selfish as that. She shut the empty telescope and shoved it under the bed. "Is there any hot water?" she said. "The boys ought to have baths."
"So should you," Kristen said.
"They're out playing around the barn. You look after yourself first."
"Maybe I will," Elsa said. "A bath will feel good. I'll bring the tub up here."
"I can get it.
Let me," Kristen said. "Please."
She was out the door, and Elsa let her go. Slowly she unbuttoned her blouse and took it off, unhooked her corset, unlaced her shoes. Kristen labored in with two pails of steaming water, went out again after the tub. As she set the tub down, she looked at Elsa, and Elsa saw her eyes widen and her mouth twist. She was looking at the burned arm. Elsa raised it and laughed a little.
"Oh, Els, how did you do it?" Kristen said.
"The coffee urn tipped over." Kristen came up and touched the smooth, whitish scar that prevented the arms being completely straightened.
"It must have been awful," she said. "Were you alone?"
"Do you want to blame that on him, too?" Elsa said. Kristen stammered, flushing.
"He was there," Elsa said. "He carried me down to the doctor."
"Oh." Kristen stood, twisting her engagement ring around on her finger. "He isn't as bad as all of you always thought he was," Elsa said bitterly.
"I'm sorry, Elsa. Honestly, I didn't mean to—"
"Oh, let's not," Elsa said.
"Please, Kristen.
I didn't mean to snap at you either. I just get tangled up. I can feel it all through the house, the way they blame him for everything.
I'm as much to blame as he is.
Do you know what Dad said to me after we got your wire?" Kristen sat down on the bed and took both of Elsa's hands.
"He'd talked it all over with Sarah, and you know what he said? He said he wanted me to keep you occupied and stay around and do things with you, because this whole thing was going to be pretty hard on Sarah."
"On Sarah?
Oh, Els, she's still ashamed of marrying Dad, and she dislikes you for it somehow. I know she does."
"Does she?"
Elsa said. "I gave up disliking her a long time ago. She married Dad because she was alone and didn't have any place to turn. I couldn't dislike her for that very long. And besides, he's doing me a favor if he asks you to look after me.
Isn't he?"
"I think Dad would be all right if it weren't for her," Kristen said. "She's just got so good. He missed you after you went away, but she keeps reminding him of all the sins, she says Beau does. When you came back before, she didn't want Dad to let you. That's the only time I ever heard him get mad at her and bawl her out.
Oh, well, Elsa said, I'll try to find work somewhere, and then we won't have all this. I'm just so tired now, I guess I don't care what they think.
When George and I get married in April, you come and live with us, Kristen said. Elsa smiled.
I guess I don't want to wish that on you, she said. I thought maybe I could keep house for Erling on the farm.
You don't want to go out on that farm and get snowed in all winter. You stay right here. You've got more right here than Sarah has. I wouldn't let her drive me out.
We'll see, Elsa said.
She didn't actually want much to go out to the farm. The farm was the one part of home that was spoiled for her. The winter when Beau had nearly gone crazy out there would keep coming up and reminding her of things she didn't want to remember.
You're thin, Kristen said on the second morning. You need to rest and eat a lot.
After that, things were set beside her at the table, casually, slyly. Her plate was heaped before she could refuse. She got second helping she didn't want. She tried. She ate till she was stuffed. She let herself be supinely carried off for naps after lunch. But all the time she was aware that her father and Sarah were not a part of this plan. They were like strangers on a bench, making room for her to squeeze in, but asking no questions, inviting no confidences, interesting themselves in what had absorbed them before her arrival. They would not welcome her, but they would make room out of Christian charity.
Still, she could forget often that they didn't want her.
She couldn't forget Beau and the cafe and Seattle and the orphanage, could look at the children and see them blooming and be thankful at least for their sakes. Chester was in school, Bruce was teasing to go too, devoting himself for hours to crayons and slates curled on the floor in the dining room. In the mild, brooding early winter days, Elsa often sat in the dining room sewing and watched his absorbed play-learning and was grateful. On Sunday afternoons her father took his nap in the dining room on a couch crowded into the corner, his fingers trailing on the floor among the trailing fringes of the cover. The boys, unable to subdue themselves to Sunday, were in and out, pestering. They sneaked up to tickle Grandpa with feathers, and he played with them as Elsa had never seen him play with his own children. Even the unrelaxing sternness of his face after the first few uncertain days could not fool them. On the pretense of having protection against the flies, he took a fly swatter with him to his nap, waving it up out of his doze occasionally. He seemed to sleep, his mustaches faintly blowing as he breathed, and the boys crept forward, smothering giggles, stretching their feathers far out. They would be right at his nose, only an inch away. When one blue eye would open like a shutter, the stern eyebrows would scowl, and the fly swatter would swish around their legs.
"Preacher's tales," he would roar at them. "Mosquito shadows."
Watching that, or watching the boys playing with the neighborhood children, Elsa hadn't the heart to look for work yet. She couldn't take them away just when they were tasting normal childhood, making friends, feeling themselves secure. So she kept her own feelings quiet and made herself useful in the house. She helped preserve meat at butchering time, made head cheese and sausage, and tried lard. And when there was nothing else to do, she could help Kristen with her trousseau. Most of her clothes had to be made, for her father would stand for no nonsense like shopping tours in Minneapolis. So Elsa made nightgowns and dresses and petticoats and blouses, hemmed sheets and pillowcases, crocheted lace, working as if it were her own hope chest that was being filled, and not her sister's.
"You're wonderful at sewing, Else," Kristen said once. "Why don't you make things for yourself instead of helping me all the time? You could stand some new clothes."
Elsa bit off a thread, threaded the needle, and pulled the end down.
"I don't need any new clothes."
"You do, too.
What for?"
There was no answer to that. But even the unfailing recourse of sewing for Kristen could not occupy more than her hands, and to keep from thinking she often sang. Sometimes in the midst of a song she would break off abruptly, wondering why she sang at all. She wasn't happy enough to sing, certainly only dormant, as if half of her slept.
She remembered times when she had been happy enough to sing, the old days when she had sung alto in the church choir, evenings in Hardanger, even in Grand Forks, so miserably burdened with the weight of that hotel. She remembered evenings coming home from somewhere in the buggy when she and Beau had sat together with their voices going up in old tunes. Beau had a nice voice, she thought, wanly, full and rich. She remembered the nodding tip of the buggy whip against the sky, the windy freshness of the air of those lost evenings, and Beau's laughter, his rich, warm, possessive laughter, and the fool songs he knew, dozens of them, as if his mind were flypaper to catch all sorts of buzzing tunes. When she got that far in her remembering, she always broke off, sang some other song, one that had no echoes except those that sounded down the green avenue of her childhood. Sometimes Henry Mossman came to call, and everybody always assumed that he came to see Nels Norgard, and the two men sat in the parlor while the women worked or darned or chatted in the dining room. But Elsa knew why he came, and she sat sometimes studying his stooped, apologetic figure with a kind of regret, remembering that once he had wanted to marry her, that if she had, she might have got what she now so desperately wanted. With a little shake of the head, she would let amazement run through her mind at the way people changed. 9 years ago, silly and young and full of confidence that she knew just what she wanted to do with her life, she had run away from Indian Falls and Henry Mossman and the stodgy, uneventful life of the town, and now she almost wished she had chosen the other way. Henry was so mild and inoffensive and docile, so unwilling even to say straight out that he came to see her, not her father, and he sat in the parlor half a dozen evenings talking to Nels Norgard and saying hardly more than 10 words to Elsa. He was steady, incapable of a harsh word to anybody, kind, unattractive, dependable. She wished once, with a sigh, that Beau, with all his arrogant ease, his sharpness, his powerful and well-tuned body, might have had just a touch of Henry's dependable quietness. But before she had half thought it, she was thinking almost proudly that Beau could never be like Henry. He wasn't a domestic animal. He wasn't tame. He couldn't like halters, no matter how hard he tried. And he did try, had tried, often. It just wasn't in him. She had probably helped along his unhappiness and her own by trying to turn him into something he was never cut out to be. Just by marrying him she had done that. Carl had known it right from the beginning. Beau was a rambler, and the responsibilities of marriage would never sit easily on his back. George Nelson, blonde, laughing, very much in love with Kristen, came down from his Minneapolis law office and stayed for 2 days at Thanksgiving, and when he was gone, Kristen folded up and put away the dress she had stolen out of her trousseau and threw herself into crocheting pillow-slip lace. "You must be planning to spend all your life in bed," Elsa said. "You've already got 6 or 8 pairs done." Kristen blushed, let her hands stop, and looked up with her face strained as if she were about to cry. "I should think you'd hate me, Elsa." "For goodness sake, why?" "Because I'm so happy." Sympathy again, Elsa thought. Poor Elsa. But she wasn't angry. Kristen was so full of her happiness, and she had to be spendthrift, share it with everybody. "I'm as glad as I can be," Elsa said. They were on the edge of the old, forbidden ground. A silence like a drawn curtain came between them. "You like George, don't you?" Kristen said from the other side of the curtain. "Very much. I always did." "You think he'll make a good husband, don't you?" "I don't know anyone I'd rather see you marry," Elsa said. Kristen picked at a knot in the lace, her eyes hiding. "I think he's wonderful," she said. "So do I," Elsa said, crocheting steadily. "Not as wonderful as you do, but wonderful enough." "I suppose every bridegroom seems wonderful to the bride," Kristen said. "Oh, Elsa, I wish—" "What?" "I wish you were as happy as I am. You deserve such a lot, and you never got a thing." "Maybe I don't deserve very much," Elsa said. "And how do you know I never got anything?" She straightened a square of lace and laid it aside. "'That's 14,' she said. 82 more, and you'll have your bedspread.'
Kristen stood up. "'I've got to run down to the post office. George said he'd write the minute he got back.'
She stood in the doorway, struggling into her coat.
"'Don't you think it's cute the way his hair curls up above his ears?' she said.
She went out, letting the storm door bang.
In a few minutes the door slammed again, and Kristen blew in a cloud of snow. She was some time taking off her coat and hanging it in the hall. Out in the kitchen, Sarah was rattling pans. Then Kristen came in.
"'Get your letter?' Elsa asked.
"'Uh-huh.
You don't seem very excited. Didn't he put any kisses at the bottom?'
"'Oh, it's a nice letter,' Kristen said. She went to the table and ruffled through the papers there.
"'Is anything wrong?'
"'No,' Kristen turned around. "'There's a letter for you, that's all.'
She took it out of her pocket.
"'For me?'
Elsa's hand came out halfway. Her eyes jumped to meet Kristen's.
"'From him,' Kristen said.
She seemed unwilling to give it up.
"'Oh, I wish he'd let you alone,' she said. "'When it's all over with, he ought to have decency enough—'
She threw the letter at Elsa and went out into the kitchen, leaving Elsa alone with the envelope, a warm, speaking, dangerous thing under her fingers. The letter was postmarked Seattle. He had come back to Washington then and found her gone. She tore open the end and very slowly drew out the letter, a fat one. There was a money order folded into it, $200. Straightening the sheets, she read—
Dear Elsa, if this letter doesn't reach you, I don't know what I'll do. I've been about crazy since I came down here a week ago and found out you'd left the place in Richmond a long time back. I've been hunting all over Seattle, had a detective on the job and everything, and finally I found out you'd worked in that store and got your address from a guy there, but the landlady said she didn't know where you'd gone. So I just have to shoot in the dark and hope you went home. You should have written me and told me about the cafe. I thought you'd make out there all right, and after you shut me out that night I was so mad and sick I didn't know what I was doing. I wrote a letter a month ago with a check in it. Did you get it? Oh, damn it, Elsa, I don't know what to say. I'm getting along fine up in Canada. Bought some real estate and ought to make some dough in the spring, but I'm lonesome for you and the kids all the time. If you've gone home to stay with your folks, I wish you'd think it over, and in the spring come up here with me. I'm really in on the ground floor here, even if Purcell does own the whole valley. This road is opening up a country as big as Dakota, and there's plenty of homestead land open yet. I'm looking out for a half section in a good place with water. Sometimes you can preempt another quarter along with the homesteaded quarter if the guy who homesteaded it first hasn't made his improvements. This land will grow wheat 6 feet high. And if we could get into some business in town and have a half section for farming in the summer, we'd be set. This town, or this place where they will be a town, is going to have a lot of opportunities in it. As we get rolling, we could buy up more land in the town site and clean up a barrel of money from the people who'll be flocking in here in 6 months. There's white clay along the river that a fellow from Medicine Hat says is just right for pottery. Coal, too, lignite, the hills are full of it. And some fellows were around there when I left snooping for oil. If we owned some land and oil was struck on it, we'd be on Easy Street for life. We can't make any mistake on this place. It's what I've been looking for all my life. It isn't all skimmed off and gobbled up. Elsa, I miss you and the kids, and this proposition looks so good I hate to think that now we stand a chance to make some money you aren't with me anymore. It's no satisfaction to make money just for yourself. I can't seem to get steamed up about it alone. I guess if you're really set on leaving me, I can't kick because I had it coming the way I acted. But I wish you'd think it over. In a new country like that, we could start all over. This town will be a nice place to live. It's on the White Mud River, and there'd be swimming and hunting and riding for the kids and plenty of brush for them to run in. The country reminds me some of my old hometown in Illinois, only there aren't any trees except in the river valley. I caught 4 beaver and a half dozen muskrats in traps in the week before I came down to the States. That shows you how wild it still is. Beavers swim right out in the river under the railroad bridge. You think it over, Elsa. We don't want to go breaking up the family and not give the kids a chance.
I have to go back to White Mud right away, but if you get this, write me and let me know you're all right. I'm sending on some money. If you need more, let me know, and I can rake it up. I was going to invest this $200 in another lot, but then I thought you'd probably need it, especially when I found out you hadn't been able to make the cafe go. And you'd better decide to come up here in the spring. I promise you nothing like that other will happen anymore. I guess I learned something from that night. All my love, Beau. P.S. I want to send on something for a Christmas package. Can't tell much what you need, but I'll try to find something useful. I know you never did like Jewjaws.
So he had finally struck something that promised to pay off. She had always believed that someday he would. If you tried enough things, sooner or later something was bound to turn out. But she mustn't, she thought almost desperately. She mustn't let herself be softened. It was a nice letter, and it made her want to do just what she knew she shouldn't do. But she would hang on to what she knew. She knew he couldn't promise to change what he was. The thing she feared in him, the thing that had made her shut him out that night, was still there, deep in his violent and irritable and restless blood. Or was it? Was there a chance that only poverty, bad luck, dissatisfaction brought that out in him? Was there a chance that in a new place, living the way he wanted to, making enough money to satisfy him, that side of him would never come out anymore? She looked up to see Kristen standing in the sliding doors between dining room and parlor. Her eyes were accusing. Pugnaciously she came in and sat down, her whole expression saying that she was not going to get up again until this thing was talked over and settled. Elsa sat still.
"What did he say?"
Kristen said. Elsa shrugged.
"Sent some money. Wants me to come up to Canada in the spring."
"He would," Kristen said.
"That's the kind he is. He'd abuse you for 8 or 9 years and then expect you to come crawling back for more. I wouldn't even have opened his letter."
"He's still my husband," Elsa said. "I wrote Dad once about helping me get a divorce, but he wouldn't do anything unless I had the one reason the church accepts. And Beau's never looked at another woman. You dislike him too much, Chris. He sent me $200 in this letter."
"It's a bribe," Kristen said. "He'll send you money to get you back, and then you'll have rags and beatings again."
"Beatings?" Sitting forward on the edge of her chair, Kristen let her eyes bore into Elsa's.
"He did beat you, didn't he?"
"My goodness, no." Kristen sat back reluctantly, only half-believing.
"But you aren't going back to him, are you?"
"I was just wondering," Elsa said. She stared at the cherry-red mica squares on the door and the parlor heater and shook her head tiredly.
"No, I don't think so."
"Because you don't know what he's done to you," Kristen said. "When you went away, you were young and pretty and healthy and everything, and you came back with your arm hurt, so it'll always show, and without decent clothes, and looking like an old woman," Elsa said.
"That isn't what I meant. You're pretty yet, only you look so tired and thin. Sometimes when you don't know anybody's looking at you, you look so worn out, you scare me. Elsa, you look just the way I remember Ma."
She gave the spring handle of the poker a hard kick, and it rattled against the stove legs.
"I guess I can still manage to get around," Elsa said. "People needn't wear themselves out worrying about me."
"He's taken the heart out of you," Kristen said helplessly.
"Even if he didn't beat you or burn your arm, he led you such a life that he's taken the heart right out of you. You used to be so spunky and independent and make Erling and me toe the mark, and now you're so quiet and kind you make me want to cry."
She was crying as she said it. Elsa put out a hand and touched her.
"Then he's been good for me," she said. "At least I may have learned to keep my temper. It isn't a matter of keeping it, it's having it to keep. You don't seem to ever want anything for yourself anymore, and that's not natural, Elsa."
"Let's not talk any more about it," Elsa said.
"Why don't you get a divorce in spite of Dad?"
Elsa laughed a little.
"I don't know how. I don't even know how to begin. and I haven't any money for a lawyer. George would help you, and get him and you in Dutch with Dad. George wouldn't care. Then you'd be free of him. You wouldn't always be getting letters.
One since I came, Elsa said dryly.
And worrying yourself about him. You're thinking about him all the time and worrying.
And then what would I do? Elsa said, rising. A divorce wouldn't change things any.
You could get married again.
After a short, incredulous stare, Elsa laughed.
Don't be silly. Henry would still marry you.
You make him sound very charitable, Elsa said. I remember what you used to say about Henry. She held the blue, indignant eyes for a minute.
Don't you like Henry any more? Kristen said.
Certainly. I always did like him. They stared at each other, and by a sudden emotional shift in the wind, they were both close to anger. As they stared, Kristen's face changed. Her eyebrows lifted, her lips came together.
Elsa, she said, you're still in love with Beau.
Elsa turned away.
Well, what of it?
She said harshly. Chapter 5 Elsa stood above the kitchen range, the glow of its slow heat on arms and face, making Christmas pastry. It was the day before Christmas. Kristen, Sarah, and the boys were doing some last-minute shopping. Her father had gone out to the farm after Erling. On the table behind her, a mound of sugar-dusted Fattigmann's Bachelsi, almost poured off on the floor. The back of the stove was sheeted with grey lefse. A wide crock in the cupboard was heaped with Goro Brut. She turned over a lefse sheet, browning in spots like broad freckles, and dropped a new batch of Fattigmann into the kettle of fat. The kitchen was full of rich smells. She smiled a little, remembering how excited the boys were. This would be a Christmas they would remember, the kind of Christmas kids ought to have. She thought, too, of what Beau's Christmas would be like in that raw little settlement in Saskatchewan. A few drinks with some other men, probably. Perhaps a bowl of Tom and Jerry batter in his bunkhouse, the way they used to have it in Dakota. Just that, and her own futile, wept-over parcel, with the knitted muffler and the gloves and the heavy homemade socks. One parcel to be ripped open in the post office, or wherever he got his mail. And instead of the warmth and ritual and color, the tree and the decorations and the bountiful eating that brought the old country close that one day of the year, and the reunion of people tied by blood and traditions, there would be only his drinks with a few other men as lonely as himself in a little unformed, unhistoried town of a half-dozen frame shacks. But that was what he wanted. That was the natural result of the itch in his bones and the restlessness in his mind. She thought it odd that he should be lonely, as his letter said he was, as herself knew he was. For all his strength and violence, he was oddly dependent in some ways, like a child. Like Bruce, she thought in surprise. He was really more like Bruce than like Chester, though they had both always thought Chet the image of him. The doublings of her own mind wearied her. As she lifted the Fattigmann, brown and cake-smelling from the fat, she saw her bare right arm, the ridge of white scar in the bend of the elbow. She would always, apparently, wear Beau in her as she wore that scar. Yet she had to make up her mind. She had to answer his letter, let him know what she would do. And she had to decide what to do about this house that echoed constantly of home, but was home no longer. The front door slammed. She heard the stamping of feet in the hall, Sarah's admonitions to the boys to clean the snow off their shoes. They all came in together, the boys rosy with the cold, Sarah pulling a wisp of hair up under her net, Kristen carrying packages. She dumped them on the floor by the cistern pump.
"Elsa," she said, "could you—"
She stopped, looked at the piles of pastry, pulled off her gloves.
"You're awful busy, though."
"I'm just about done. What is it?"
"George is going to be here at 6 o'clock, and that green dress doesn't fit right around the neck."
"Sure, just a minute." Elsa moved the kettle of fat off the stove, gave a sugared Fattigmann to each of the boys, standing with their tongues between their lips at the table, and shooed them out.
Kristen picked up 3 or 4 big packages and followed her upstairs.
While Elsa worked on the dress, she said nothing, but when the collar was going back on, she jerked her head at one large parcel. "That came for you in the mail," she said. They looked at each other, then at the square package.
"Yes," Elsa said. "He said something about a Christmas parcel."
Though she wouldn't have shown it to Kristen, she was excited. Beau would have some part in this Christmas. He hadn't forgotten, and he wouldn't be forgotten. She was so busy getting Kristen ready for George that she had no time to open it then, and later there was supper, and then the dishes, and then a quick change into a dress-up dress for the Christmas tree. But that was all right. Let it be a surprise, to her and to all of them. They thought he was so low and vicious. Let them see right out in the open that he could be thoughtful, too. The house was full. Sarah's 2 sisters had come over. George was down from Minneapolis, Erling in from the farm. Groaning full with lutefisk, kjodkager, riesengrot, anchovy salat, 6 kinds of pastry, pleasantly warmed by the grape wine traditional with Christmas feasts, they crowded into the parlor, sitting on chairs and floor, wherever there was room. George and Kristen sat on the floor under the Christmas tree, Sarah on a straight chair, Nels Norgard on the couch between Sarah's sisters. He quizzed them in Norwegian, and smiled a little grimly at their halting and giggling answers. Erling had slipped out immediately after supper. Chester stuck his head in between Grandpa and Hilda Veld.
"There ain't any Santa Claus, is there?"
"Whew!
There ain't any Santa Claus that comes down the chimney, is there?"
"I knew a boy once that didn't believe in Santa Claus," Grandpa said. "You know what he got for Christmas? An orange. And the orange was spoiled."
"Ah," Chet said.
He retreated to whisper with Bruce.
When Elsa came in, Bruce ran up to her.
"Mom?"
"What is it?"
"Chet says he ain't gonna come."
"Isn't. We don't say ain't. But he'll come. Chet's just trying to be smart."
"Ah, I know," Chet said. "I know."
There was a knock on the door, and Elsa went to open it. It was Henry Mossman, stooping and smiling and apologetic.
"Merry Christmas," he said. "Can I butt in on the celebration?"
"Sure thing. Come in." Henry bowed and spoke all around, the parcel he carried looking uncomfortably prominent in his hands. Elsa told him to put it under the tree.
"When do the festivities start?" he said.
"Any time now. Erling's out getting ready." Henry looked at the boys, secretive in their corner.
"They don't look half excited, do they?" he said, and laughed.
Elsa half turned away and smoothed the papers on the library table. For an instant, a thought had sneaked into her mind. Just the sight of Henry's unaffected kindness, the way he looked at the boys as if he loved them both, made her see him for an instant as their father. They'd have walked all over him from the time they were born, but they would have loved him. They wouldn't ever have known what it was to hate or fear him. Outside, there was the faint jangle of sleigh bells. Nels Norgard rose and shooed them all toward the kitchen, reached over and picked up the lamp.
"All out," he said. "All out, all out. He won't come in if he sees us."
The boys, frantic with excitement, hung back, escaped, had to be rounded up and herded. George and Kristen were hurriedly lighting the tree candles in their pink clamp sockets. The tree glowed, the strings of popcorn gleamed white, there was a rich red glitter from the long festoons of cranberries, a shimmer from the glass bubbles and ornaments. Motioning Henry to go in with the others, Elsa ran upstairs and collected her packages, piled her arms, stooped and caught her fingers in the cord of Beau's parcel, felt her way down the dark stairway again. Kristen was pushing packages under the tree. In the 3 minutes since the lamp had been removed, the floor under the tree had been mounded with gifts. Elsa pushed her packages in with the others, turned and saw Erling's face grinning in through the window over a bushy white beard.
"Hurry up,"
Erling said, his voice faint through the storm windows.
"It's cold out here in this monkey suit."
The boys burst loose when she slipped into the kitchen.
"Is he here?"
Bruce said.
"I heard him up on the roof," she said. "He got stuck in the chimney for a minute, or I'd never have got out in time."
She peered out the door. The partition between dining room and parlor cut off the tree, but she saw the flutter of its lights on the wall. There was the soft sound of the front door opening. She turned to her father.
"Blow out the light," she said.
"Then we can let the boys creep out and peek at him." The kitchen went dark in a puffed breath. Sarah's sisters, somewhere in the dark, whispered and giggled.
"Shh!"
Jester said fiercely, three times as loud as the whisper had been. Taking the boys' hands, Elsa tiptoed them carefully into the dining room, where she stood with finger on lips and leaned to look through the double doors. Erling, in a Santa Claus suit, was standing in front of the fireplace, cramming long scrolls of candy into the stockings. From a bag he poured streams of peanuts and butternuts and almonds and crowned each stocking with a tangerine. The tree was barricaded with new packages, brightly wrapped. Candy canes hung from the tree, and there was a shimmer, a glitter, the whole fairy wonder of childhood in the room. She pulled the boys close so they could peek. They bent, stared. She felt their bodies rigid with awe. Even Chet, the unbeliever, did not breathe for minutes. Against their will, they were tugged back into the kitchen. Sarah lighted the lamp again, and the room full of people stood looking at the two boys, every pair of eyes watching the dazed entrancement in their faces. Bruce looked up at his mother, crowded against her legs, smiled wanly, and began unaccountably to cry. Sleigh bells jangled again loudly, diminished as if moving away.
"There he goes," Chet said.
They piled out of the kitchen, and the boys stopped short for a moment when they saw, well-lighted now and in plain view, the piles of gifts. Then they fell upon the loaded tree. For a half hour there was pandemonium as they ripped open parcels, exposing Indian suits, revolvers, pencil boxes and crayons, tricycles, her father's gift, lavish, unheard of. The room was full of bird-like chirps of joy. Henry and George went around salvaging packages from the boys' rapacious hands and distributing them to their rightful owners. With surprise, Elsa found herself pressed with gifts. It had not occurred to her, in her desire to make this Christmas one that the children would always remember, that she would herself be remembered. Christmas before had always been a kind of hurried pushing back of the world's leanness, a hasty and dutiful gift-giving always soured just a little by Beau's contempt for the whole business. Spend a lot of money and get people things they'd never buy themselves and would never use. She wished he could see this, the fine wholeheartedness of this feast. Her lap was full of things, gloves and a new dress from Kristen, a lavalier from Erling, a sternly practical sewing basket from Sarah and her father, even a brush and comb and mirror backed with ivory from Henry Mossman. She stammered on her thanks, and her eyes betrayed her, so that she got up and began picking up scattered wrappings and feeding them into the heater. If Beau could only see it just once, could only know just once that feeling of family loyalty and love and thanksgiving that was like a song sometimes, when Christmas went right, he would know what she missed and why she missed it. Then she thought of Beau's package. Chet collided with her, riding his tricycle around the room, and she caught his shoulder.
"There's a package from Pa," she said,
and steered him toward the tree. Bruce wheeled up, avid for more plunder, while she groped under the low branches and found the parcel. The babble of voices went on behind her while she cut the string. The lips of the cardboard box spread apart. Wadded newspaper came first, then a package wrapped in brown paper. She wished she had had time to open the things first and rewrap them prettily. Beau wouldn't have had any chance where he was to get nice wrappings, and now his presents looked shoddy by comparison with the others. She supposed Sarah and her father, even Kristen, would notice that and hold it against him. The boys were clamoring at her shoulder. George Nelson, his eyes crinkled with a smile at the corners, bent to help her. For a moment, with the brown and dowdy package in her hand, she felt a twinge of fear, a tiny, cold premonition. The voices behind her had dropped, and she knew they were all watching.
"It looks," she said, "it looks as if it had been opened."
"Customs," George said. "They'd have to open anything coming in from Canada."
Oh,
she said, relieved. Her fingers unrolled the paper. A pair of overshoes came in sight, and her eyes went blurry, her whole body stiff with disappointment, as she looked at them. On her knees, the children over her shoulder, she hung as if clinging for her life. The overshoes were smeared with yellow mud from top to sole. Frantically, telling herself it was a joke, a bad joke, but meant to be funny, she unrolled the second package. Another smaller pair of overshoes, smeared like the first ones. Bruce's voice, shrill, angry at being cheated, cut through the room. "Why, they're old!" he said. Elsa's face was hot as fire, her blood so wild with rage that she felt smothered. Violently she tore the paper off the third parcel and shook out the contents. It was a coat with a fur collar. There was mud spattered on it, and the collar, ripped half off, hung askew. Not a person in the room said a word as she stood up. She fought to smile, fought to make her voice bright.
"All right," she said. "That's all. They must have got dirtied by the customs inspectors. We'll wash them off tomorrow. Time for bed now."
Henry Mossman picked up one of the overshoes and rubbed with his fingers at the dried mud.
"That's about the worst I ever saw," he said. "Open packages and ruin everything in them."
He looked at Elsa, and his eyes dropped.
"I'll wash them off at the pump," he said. "They must have thrown them down in a puddle and stamped on them." "Thank you, Henry,"
Elsa said, the stiff smile still on her face. She motioned to Chet and Bruce. Chet looked at her solemnly, hanging to the handlebars of his tricycle.
"Is that all Pa sent?" he said. "Is that all, Ma?"
Sick and humiliated, furious at the people in the room who sat silently and watched her shame, she herded them off to bed. She did not come down again, but went to bed to lie wakeful, bitter and raging, cringing at the thought of facing all of them tomorrow, beating against the brutal, unanswerable question of why he had sent things like that for Christmas gifts. Because she didn't believe any more than the people downstairs did that the customs inspectors were responsible. Even the explanation, when it came, only made her bite her lips in vexation. That was the way Beau was, and there was no changing him. Everything he did was characteristic, blind, yet from one point of view reasonable, practical, full of insensitive logic. The letter came 2 days after Christmas. The envelope had been stamped "Return to Sender," and stamps had been stuck on over the post office lettering. It was meant to reach her before the package, but he had forgotten the stamps, again, characteristically. She read it coming home from town, where she had fled to escape the house, get clear of Sarah's closed and vindicated face, and the children's sullen reluctance to wear their scrubbed overshoes. The day before she had sat a long time mending the ripped collar of the coat, and her whole mind had been one impossible question.
Why?
It was a nice coat with a fox collar. It had cost a good deal. But the smears of mud, the rips, to buy new things and then spoil them before putting them in the mail. "Dear Elsa," the letter said, "there hasn't been any answer to my letter except that postcard saying you were staying at home. What's the matter, honey? I've been up here working my head off to get a steak, and you won't even write more than a postcard. I know you had a tough time in Richmond, but I honestly thought the joint would give you a living. Anyway, I'm sorry, but I told you that before. You don't know how lonesome a place like this can be, just sitting around the stove and spitting in the door with a lot of section hands that don't know their behinds from 30 cents a week. The place is dead as a doornail with winter here, and so cold you can't stick your nose out without freezing it off. The foreman of the Half Diamond Bar and I got the chink cook to stick his tongue on a cold doorknob the other day, and he liked to tore all the hide off it trying to get away. You never heard such a jabber. But there isn't much doing. I've been drawing plans for a house I might build if you don't spoil everything by staying mad. 4 gables, a bedroom in each one, and a big veranda. I've got 3 lots along the river on the high side where it won't ever flood out, and I'm sort of reserving one for us.
You and the kids would like it up here. It's a swell climate in summer. Sunshine 16 hours a day. I sent a box for Christmas today. When you open it, you'll find the overshoes dirty and the coat torn a little because I found out that new clothes sent across the line had a big duty slapped on them. But you can send second-hand ones without any duty. Money don't grow on trees so thick that I could afford to miss foxing the customs guys. The collar ought to sew right back on, and you can wash the mud off the boots easy. I got the coat when I came through Moose Jaw after I left Seattle. The collar is gray fox. I hope you think of me once in a while when you wear it, and that you'll write me a decent letter and say you'll come up here in the spring. Love, Beau. P.S. Merry Christmas. Tell the kids Merry Christmas, too. If Chet is in school now, maybe he has learned to write and can write his old man a letter.
Elsa leaned against a tree and sighed and laughed aloud and crushed the letter in her hand. Every word from him was full of the tangle of emotional pulls that had wearied her mind for months. He missed her. He missed the boys. He would love a letter from Chet. She could imagine his pride as he showed such a letter around. He honestly wanted her back. He would promise anything. And he sent her gifts that were not gifts, but slaps in the face that shamed her for him in front of everybody. Yet the gifts had been well meant. It was only the saving of a few miserable dollars of duty that had made him spoil them. And his optimism, his incurable conviction that this time he was going to make his pile, the old, endless, repetitive story of his whole life. A letter from him always weakened her resolution, made her wonder if she were doing right to stay away from him. Before she could soften herself too much with thinking, she went home and wrote him a letter she could not help making kind. But she couldn't come back. The boys were coming out of their kinks. They had something like a home for the first time. They had friends and playmates and were healthy and happy. She was dreadfully sorry and unhappy, but she couldn't risk their futures any more. If he wanted a divorce, she would agree, because she couldn't expect him not to want to be free under the circumstances. She had used the two checks he sent for the boys, and was keeping what was left to be spent on them when they needed things. He needn't feel any responsibility for her. The kids talked about him a lot. They hadn't forgotten him. Across the bottom she wrote her thanks for the Christmas gifts, and she could not bring herself to mention how they had been received. It was a lovely coat. The overshoes were very useful in the deep snow they were having. The thought of how much he might be hurt if she told him the truth, how he had spent a lot of money on the coat and was staying up in a lonesome village hoping she might come back to him, kept her pen in the easy platitudes of thanks. She would lie before she would hurt him that way. Chapter 6. It was almost as if the necessity of protecting him, of keeping from him the knowledge of what a catastrophe his gifts had been, made the problem of living under the shadow of her family's unspoken condemnation harder to bear. She found herself on the brink of flaring out and defending him a half dozen times, when their talk or their gestures or their very silence steered close to the disapproval they felt. They had known it all the time, their silence said, and now they were half pleased to have their judgment vindicated. Sometimes she felt like shouting at them, and as Kristen's marriage came closer, she felt more and more how impossible it would be to stay on after her one friend was gone from the house. If it hadn't been for the children, she would not have stayed a week. Then, in mid-April, Kristen was married, and after she and George had fled in a shower of rice and old shoes for a honeymoon in Florida that made Sarah lift her eyes in deprecation of such ungodly extravagance, the house was the dull burying ground she had known it would be. Her life went on from day to day by sufferance, not by any will or direction of its own. The weeks crept through their routine of housework and Sunday quiet. Sarah went beside her through the house like a mute, walked the four blocks to and from church like an automaton, spoke hardly 10 words a day. Even the lavish flowering of the wild plum tree by the side of the house and the misty green spread below her bedroom window were tinged with the melancholy of something long lost and pass reclaiming. Her heart was no longer in this house. There was nothing for her here. On the last day of April, when she was sweeping the porch, Henry Mossman came by and stood with his hat in his hand and asked her if she would like to bring the boys and come on a picnic the next Saturday afternoon. He asked her lamely, not knowing how she, a married woman, would feel about going out with him, humbly ready to assume that probably she wouldn't want to.
"I just remembered that other picnic we went on once," he said, "pretty near 10 years ago, when we had the buggy race and your dad walked on his hands." "That was a lovely day," she said. "I've never forgotten it. Like to come this time? We might be lucky and get another perfect day."
"I shouldn't," she said. "I might get you talked about, Henry."
"That's what I was wondering," Henry said. "Not about me, about you."
"It wouldn't bother me."
"Then let's go," Henry said. "Nobody who ever knew you would talk about you a minute, and the rest of them don't matter."
He lifted his face and smiled. She noticed how fine his eyes were, what a sweet and quizzical and gentle expression he always wore.
"The boys ought to have fun," Henry said. "I'll come around about one, then."
Standing with her back to the unfriendly house, she felt the sudden trembling as if tears were fighting to emerge. She said,
"I guess I've never known anyone as kind as you, Henry."
Henry quirked his lips in his half-humorous, self-derogatory smile.
"I'd rather hear you say that than anyone I can think of," he said.
That was on Wednesday. On Friday, the boy from the station came up with a telegram for Elsa Mason. It was from Beau, and he was in Minneapolis. He wanted her to meet him there Saturday afternoon.
"I'm dreadfully sorry, Henry," she said. "It's just that he's come a long way."
"Sure," he said.
"Of course. You want to go."
He stood behind the counter of his hardware store in a black alpaca jacket, stroking the ends of his mustache, and her own uncertain state made her clairvoyantly sensitive to the stages by which he put away his disappointment.
"You were banking on it," she said. "I'm awfully sorry."
Henry reached out and swung the handles of 3 rakes hanging from the rafter.
"Well, I won't say I'm glad he came just when he did."
She felt driven to explain, to justify Beau and herself.
"I guess he won't come down here," she said. "He knows they don't like him. But when he comes all that way, I can't just..."
"Why, sure," Henry said. "You want to go right up. Don't worry about me." Full of obscure and stubborn shame, Elsa started for the door.
"Thank you, Henry," she said.
She always seemed to hurt him, no matter how hard she tried not to. It always came down to a choice, and she always chose against him. Henry came around the counter and followed her to the entrance. The street outside lay sleepily dead. A tired horse drooped on 3 feet a few doors down.
"Elsa," Henry said.
She stopped.
"I want to tell you something," Henry said. "I had a half idea I might tell you at the picnic, sort of reproduce that one 10 years ago."
He was perfectly serious, perfectly self-assured. The awkwardness had fallen away. Even his stoop wasn't noticeable.
"I don't want to butt into anything that isn't my business," he said. "But I can't help knowing a few things. Maybe what I've heard is right and maybe it isn't. I don't care. I just want you to know what I think."
She watched him.
"One thing I want to tell you," he said, "is that no matter what other folks think of your husband, I always liked him. I never saw Mr. Mason except that one winter a little, but I liked him."
Elsa wet her lips.
"It's kind of you to say that."
"I don't know what's the trouble between you and Mr. Mason. That's none of my business either. Sarah said something once, but I didn't listen much." He looked out into the street. "I don't know what the trouble is, and there's no reason I should know. Sarah said you wanted to get a divorce and couldn't. I don't know. But if you did do anything like that, and you didn't want to stay on with your folks..." His face turned to meet hers.
I'm no better than I was 10 years ago, he said, and I'm not any younger. But I'd be proud to ask you the same thing I did then, if you should find yourself free.
Elsa bent her head. Every little thing lately seemed to make her cry.
I like Mr. Mason, Henry was saying. And you know, I'm not prying at you to get you to divorce him. I just wanted you to know, just in case, so you would have it in mind as a possibility.
She was crying quietly with her head down.
Don't, Henry said. Please, Elsa. You don't have to say anything or make up your mind or anything. You go on up on Saturday and see him, and I'll take the kids to the picnic.
It was that last kindness that put her to flight. She nodded and walked away before everything flew out of control. It was different telling Sarah. She simply announced that she was going up to see Beau in Minneapolis. Sarah stared at her, her placid, smooth face the color of dough, her slightly bulging gray eyes hard and disapproving. She looked, Elsa thought, 20 years older than her real age. She looked unhealthy, like a fungus.
"Your father won't like it," Sarah said.
"I'm sorry," Elsa said. "Why should he object?"
"You know he doesn't want you to have any more to do with that man."
"Then why wouldn't he help me get a divorce?"
"You know why? You didn't, or said you didn't, have the reason."
Elsa laughed, and she heard her laugh unpleasantly harsh in her own ears.
"I had reason. I just didn't have the little narrow reason the church recognizes.
Elsa!"
"Don't shout at me," Elsa said. "I don't know what you want me to be. I'm nothing the way I am. You won't help me divorce him, and you don't want me to go back to him, but still you act as if I were unclean when I come home to stay."
"I'm sorry," Sarah said stiffly. "We've been as kind as we know how to be."
"With a poker up your back," Elsa said. "You hush-hush around me as if he had given me some awful disease."
"He's not a good man," Sarah said.
Elsa sighed and shrugged.
"Maybe not. I don't know what a good man is anymore. But he wasn't all to blame.
She stopped, looking at Sarah's faded hair, the plump, colorless face, the quenched and somehow petulant look in the eyes. She said before she thought,
"I loved him once. We were awfully happy at first."
Sarah turned away and went into the kitchen, and Elsa looked after her, thinking. As she went upstairs to dress for the train trip, she knew that, unhappy as she was not as unhappy as Sarah, and that seemed a strange thing. She saw him before the train had fully stopped, and as people began crowding to the ends of the car, she sat in the seat, gripping the handle of her suitcase. Slowly, with a vice on her mind, she stood up. A porter took her bag, and she let it go, though she would have liked it to hang to. The steps, the black hand helping her down, the momentary confusion of turning and searching among the crowd, and then Beau's eyes, gray and sober and intent. He stepped a half-step forward, as if unsure of himself, started to speak, and stopped, and then lifted her and held her close. His voice was whispering in her ear, "Oh, Elsa, Elsa!" She shook her head, pulling away from him. Through the weak tears that came to her eyes, she saw that he was well-dressed, really handsome again in a good gray suit, and when she bent her head to blink the tears away, she saw his hand, brown, scarred with signs of labor, still holding her elbow. The hand was more definitely Beau than the handsome man in the gray suit. She knew his hands, lovely, big, square, long hands. He drew her aside. She, mindless and voiceless and almost without power to move her feet, rescued her bag from the porter and stood her against a post to look at her. His eyes were warming. He was beginning to smile.
"Ah, Elsa," he said, "you had me scared to death."
She wet her lips, trying to grope back among the fragments of what she had been going to say to him.
"Beau,
don't tell me you meant it," he said, and laughed. "Maybe you meant it when you wrote it, but you don't now. Where are the kids?"
"I left them at home, but Beau—"
"Come on," he said. "We've got a lot of talking to do.
We're going to talk so much your tongue will be tired for a month. You know what I've been doing the last 3 weeks?